Hey guys, how's it going?
Oh, really? Yeah, that's good, man. Yeah, happy to hear it.
Yeah. CNN says that Abadi says that Tikrit is liberated. Can you confirm? I just typed to Mitchell Prothero over Skype, and it says here Mitch Prothero is typing. They took the provincial government compound and Saddam's palace. Mitch Prothero is typing, says Skype. Mitch Prothero, he's McClatchy's man in Erbil, up in Kurdistan. Great reporter, man. They took the provincial government compound and Saddam's palace. Ooh, I'm on pins and needles. Oh, here we go. And have pushed into the city center, but at least three neighborhoods are still held by estimated hundreds of fighters. Ooh, and he's continuing to type. Hi, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We deliver libertarian foreign policy here. We're against it. Good day for Iraqis, but not over yet. Okay, great. Oh, he's still typing. Mitch Prothero typing. You know, this Skype, it is useful for some things, I guess. Well, it looks like major progress in the American and Iranian battle for Tikrit to take it back from the Islamic State. Abadi would argue that control of the government buildings means the government controls it. Yeah, I got you. So they're not quite done yet. But that's pretty good. Appreciate it, dude. Okay, so welcome to the show. Let me copy and paste this into my I am here for Gareth Prothero. Oops. God dang it. I know. This is no way to run a radio show. You know, I don't know, man. Skype, it's got a weird copy-paste function, doesn't it? Okay, there we go. So, progress for the battle for Tikrit. Hey, it's been an entire month for 50,000 men under the command of the Iranians to take this city, this town, from the Islamic State. But, it was just a matter of time, right? As Nancy Youssef said on the show back a few weeks ago, at the very least, American air power is keeping the Islamic State from sending reinforcements. I don't know. If it took them a month to take back Tikrit, I don't know how the hell they think they're ever going to take Fallujah, Ramadi, or Mosul. I will reiterate my fears to you that I've been telling you for at least the last year straight that it's going to take the American Marine Corps to quote-unquote liberate Mosul. Either that or they're just going to let Caliph Ibrahim be the caliph. Caliph. I guess Raqqa is the official capital of the caliphate, but yeah, Mosul is sort of the other one. And it's a big old city, man. That's not anything like Tikrit. Anyway, so there's some news from Iraq War 3 or 4, depending on whether you count Clinton's wars or not. His 8-year bombing campaign and blockade. But anyway, we'll get back to that in a minute. Let me tell you, I'm Scott Horton. Did I already say that? This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly, which means I'm against it. All of it. Everything. My website is scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there. I've been at this for 12 years now, dude. Well, I've been doing radio since 98, but I've been doing the interview show and primarily obsessed with foreign policy for 12 years. And you can find all those archives for free at scotthorton.org/interviews. 3,750-something now. Something right around there. Okay? And you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. I'm a pretty engagey type on Twitter. So you want to tweet me, you want to love me, you want to fight me, you want to whatever, stop by twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Right now, I'm just glued to Laura Rosen's feed. She's a reporter for Al Monitor and is covering the Iran talks in Lausanne, Switzerland right now. And it looks like they're not going to have a deal today, guys. They're going to push into the night. Hey, they're staying up late. Russian delegate says talks may go into early Wednesday. Sign the damn deal! You know, I can't think of a time where I ever wanted John Kerry to do anything. But in this case, sign the damn deal! Sign it! The nuclear talks. The Iranian nuclear talks. They're working on it. And I guess, come on, man. I gotta believe. I just gotta. That there's nothing that Israel can do to screw this up now. They're going to have this deal. Expanded inspections in exchange for sanctions relief. And just maybe the beginning of the end of the American Cold War with Iran. Maybe not. Maybe we'll still have a Cold War, but just without the primary excuse for it. They're safeguarded. Civilian nuclear program that's never been any threat to anyone. The pretended crisis. Man, oh man. All right. Today on the show, Karen Kotowski is going to be here. She was supposed to be on a couple weeks ago, but that didn't work out. But today it's going to. And she's going to be on to talk about how she's an eyeball witness to the neoconservatives, that is, Israel's fifth column in the United States of America, and how they lied us into war with Iraq back in 2002 and 3. She was there, an Air Force lieutenant colonel in the Pentagon, working for the man, not in the Office of Special Plans, but working for the man who also was part of the Office of Special Plans, a guy named Bill Luty. And she knows all about it, and she's going to tell you that history today on the show. And then also Todd Pierce is going to be here. Now, this is kind of long and confusing and complicated stuff here, but even if I'm not up to it, you guys will understand. I give you credit. The article is, I think it's at antiwar.com today or yesterday. It's called Neocons, the Echo of German Fascism. And it's not exactly about the Nazis as much as it is the German Conservative Revolutionary Movement. The German National People's Party. And their Nazi-like, Nazi-ish, very fascist but not quite Nazi ideology. The Nazis, their fascism to the nth degree, but these guys, the Revolutionary Conservatives, they're fascists. And what they believe is the same thing that all the neoconservatives believe. Except for, I guess, the Jew hatred. Since so many, not all, not by a long shot, but since so many of the neoconservatives are Jewish, I guess they'd have to leave out that part of the ideology. But the rest of it, where you can bow down and kiss the state's ass or die, yeah, they believe that. The part where John Locke, never heard of him. Yeah, they believe that. And anyway, Todd Pierce, he's a former defense attorney down at Guantanamo Bay, an American JAG lawyer. And he's going to be on to tell us about the German fascists and how the neoconservatives are exactly like them. Oh, I know, you're just shocked, right? Gee whiz, Scott Horton, that sounds a little extreme. Yeah, well, the neocons have gotten more than 1 million people killed in the last 12 years, haven't they? Yeah, they have. I can't believe that's a whole segment already. Well, it started off kind of slow. We'll be right back with some bad news right after this, guys. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back. I'm going back over this Todd Pierce piece here. This is really something else, man. All right. So Iran talks. Laura Rosen here reporting last night from Lausanne, I don't know, Switzerland. Working late in the night. There's still some difficult issues. John Kerry said... where's the substance here? I had it. Eh, they're optimistic enough. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said he believed progress had been made and he remained optimistic. The gaps going into the final days of talks this key round had to do with mechanisms for lifting UN Security Council sanctions, the research and development that Iran could conduct on advanced centrifuges, and enrichment in years 11 through 15 of a final accord, and a snapback mechanism for reimposing the suspended sanctions should Iran be determined to violate the accord, and who would determine that. So it's a done deal. You hear that? They got every question for years 1 through 10 of the deal resolved. After 10 years of the deal going swimmingly, yeah, there remain some questions about exactly what sorts of experiments they can use, they can do with their advanced centrifuges. It's a done deal. They're doing the deal. And if they're going to fight about that, if the deal's going to fall apart over that, well, then I quit. I'll sit here for another 12 years complaining about it is what I'll do. But no, man, this is, it's on. And one of the reports, and I'm not sure if this was Rosen, I think this was Laura Rosen earlier actually, tweeted out that they said, you know what, if we have to stay till tomorrow, we don't care. If we gotta stay through the first of next month, who cares whether the official end date is the 31st or not? If we gotta go to April Fool's Day, we'll go to April Fool's Day. Although that'll hand a talking point to Bill Kristol, so you might want to go ahead and push to the second if you gotta push to the first. But anywho, man. It's on, right? That's what that means. It's on. All they have left to quibble about is what's going to happen between years 11 through 15. Just somebody go ahead and give me the final confirmation on the finishing of this god dang thing. All right. Also, you should know Yossi Melman. He's an Israeli writer, former intelligence officer, and he's pretty hawkish, and he's written... a book about many questions of Iran's nuclear program, etc. This is for you hardcore Israeli, pro-Israeli partisans out there. He says, analysis. Emerging Iran deal is not a, quote, sword at Israel's throat. And he explains that figure of speech. He says, there is no existential threat to the Jewish state. Not even from Iran. There is no existential threat to Israel. And he says, in fact, even if the Iranians somehow got nukes from a magic wish, or if someone just handed them a boat full of hydrogen bombs or whatever it was, Israel has second strike capability. Israel has multiple submarines. They just got a brand new submarine from the Germans. They have six now. and those submarines are full of H-bombs. And that means that if Iran used their black magic, 12th Imam Shiism, to somehow obliterate Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and Sderot and the rest of Israel, the Israeli Navy would still kill every last Iranian. All of them would be burnt to death in hydrogen bomb thermonuclear fire. And so, therefore, you can go ahead and rest assured that Iran would never attack Israel, even if they had nukes. Give me a break. And the quote about the sword at the throat is, that's the only time that it would be okay to start a war would be legitimate preemption. You know, like if the British started amassing their army in Canada on the other side of the border, and Obama went ahead and bombed them before they invaded into New York State. Okay? But since that's complete fantasy, since Israel has no enemies, I mean, that they aren't backing. If I was Israeli, I don't think I would trust the al-Nusra front to keep their distance for too long. But anyway, certainly, as Yossi Melman says, there is no existential threat to Israel at all, anywhere in the world. Which brings up the question, why do the people of Israel need the government of Israel at all, huh? Wonder. But anyway, they're not in danger. And Yossi Melman, writing in the Jerusalem Post, which is a conservative paper, it's not Haaretz, which is a more left-leaning paper, writing in the Jerusalem Post, Yossi Melman is saying, everybody, just shut up for a minute. Okay? Thank you. Congress expected to push Iran's sanctions if deadline passes. Soft deadline on deal looking increasingly firm. This is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. The tentative agreement among negotiators to have the framework for Iran's final nuclear deal was never meant to be carved in stone. The end of March deadline is rapidly approaching, however, and is feeling increasingly firm. That's because the U.S. Congress, packed with hawks, eager to sabotage the deal and egged on by Israeli officials to do so, are looking to act quickly and try to impose some negotiation-killing sanctions the instant the deadline passes. Well, anyway, Obama will veto him anyway, and they won't be able to override his veto. But check out this high treason. John McCain, can you believe that Americans, by the tens of millions of Americans lined up to cast their vote for John McCain, who now is suggesting that Israel should, quote, go rogue and attack Iran. I'm not kidding. He said this during a floor speech in the well of the Imperial Senate, that Israel should attack Iran in order to sabotage the President of the United States' foreign policy and his nuclear negotiations with Iran over their peaceful, safeguarded nuclear electricity program. The Israelis need to chart their own path of resistance. On the Iranian nuclear deal, they may have to go rogue. Let's hope their warnings have not been mere bluffs. Israel survived its first 19 years without meaningful U.S. patronage. For now, all it has to do... Yeah, that's because they were allied with the Soviet Union. But anyway, for now, all it has to do is get through the next 22, admittedly long months. Yeah, because then he presumes that Jeb Bush will win, as do I. This man is, as Zaid Gilani points out here at Alternate, he's the head of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And a former presidential candidate. His call for a foreign state to openly obstruct U.S. policy and in the process initiate a catastrophic regional war is perhaps unprecedented for someone of his senior position. Quite reminiscent of that time that Nixon sent Kissinger to scotch LBJ's Vietnam peace talks in 1968. It's treason. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. and they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Writer for LouRockwell.com. Although I guess it's been a while since I've seen a new article by her. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Karen?
Hey, I'm fine. I'm fine. Yeah, I haven't been writing that much. I did have one out a few weeks ago.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
I miss your writing. You're such a great writer.
Well, thanks. I don't know. But I do need to have more discipline and produce more.
All right. Well, so let's talk about some history here. It's right around the 12th anniversary of the start of Iraq War 2 or 3, depending on whether you count Clinton's blockade or not. And you had a front row seat to this whole thing. So introduce yourself to the people, please. Name, rank, serial number, and all that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm Karen Kotowski. I'm retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. And in 2001 and 2002, I was working at the Office of Secretary of Defense. In 2002, I was working in the Near East South Asia Policy Directorate of the Office of Secretary of Defense. And this is where the Office of Special Plans sprouted out from. It was a sister office to where I worked, and we had actually shared office space with these folks. And in the summer of 2002, and of course this started before then, but in the summer of 2002, we got to see the people who were involved in really the propaganda production, which was aimed not just at the American people, which it clearly was, and it was used by the administration, by Bush, by Cheney, by Powell, by all these folks, but it was also aimed at the Pentagon itself. It was aimed at focusing this misinformation, really, that didn't have a solid, firm basis in intelligence, but this misinformation to push out the war on the Pentagon as well. So, very conflictual type of situation. Many of my friends and coworkers that wore the uniform, and also some of the civilians in the intelligence community that I worked with, all very disheartened and dismayed by what they saw. And there was nothing that could be done, because there's always something that can be done. But what was done was, when people like myself and others in that office protested or called the, waved the BS flag kind of thing, pretty much were told to sit down and shut up and get out. And most of my buddies curtailed their assignments if they disagreed with what was going on. They just found a new assignment, called their assignments officer, and got out of there. And of course, I retired about a year later when I hit my 20. So, what could really be done? Now, I did and write anonymously for the late David Hackworth, Colonel Hackworth's site. He published anonymously my observations from inside the Pentagon during the time that I was still active duty. And why did I have to publish anonymously? Well, if I had said what I was saying and identified who I was and where I worked, I would probably be in prison right now, even though nothing I said was classified. It was really just my opinion of what I was observing around me. And what I was observing around me, of course, was the development of a propaganda campaign to promote this unnecessary and inappropriate invasion of Iraq, using reasons which did not exist. And of course, the funny thing, it's not really funny, the sad thing, 4 or 5 years after that, by the mid 2000s, by 2004, five, even as early as 2003, the American people were able then to really see that these were lies, and even some parts of mainstream media were identifying the propaganda as false political lies based on getting support for this invasion. But that was too late. They were that didn't stop anything from happening. In fact, if it did anything, I think it led to even more cover-ups. I mean, we saw when 2006 or 7, when the video of what went on in Iraq shooting the civilians was released by, who's the guy who's in prison, had a sex change operation, our whistleblower dude.
Yeah, Manning.
Manning, yeah, Private Manning. He, you know, he saw what we were doing. First off, we're in a war that we lied to get into. And if you know anything about history, which you do, Scott, and I've learned since my time in the Pentagon, I've learned more about our real history. If you study the history of these wars, this of the U.S. government's intention and actions in war, you know, it's almost always based on conscious, calculated, propagandistic lies. I didn't know that in 2002 and 2001. I didn't suspect that my government was like that at that point in time, but I found out different. Mm-hmm. And historically, it actually isn't anything new. The players change. You know, the neoconservatives have had a handle on this for, you know, since the late 80s. I mean, really since the Cold War theoretically ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union. These guys have been, you know, hankering for war. Of course, none of them fight. None of their kids wear a uniform. But they love war. They love war. They love war from the window seat. And, this is who's doing it now. Historically, it has been other, politically influential groups. But right now, and at that time, it was the neocons. But what I was saying about Manning is we're in a war that's illegal, unconstitutional, based on lies, and we're doing evil, bad things. He had evidence of that, felt bad about it, and shared it with the world. And it was way, way after the fact. It was not classified. That video, most of the stuff that he released was time-sensitive stuff, which the time had long passed. So while it was classified, it didn't meet any criteria of classification other than to save political face. And, of course, they, you know, hung him out to dry for sure.
Oh, yeah.
In very upset. So the cover-ups continue. It wasn't like we stopped anything. In fact, it fostered even more cover-ups, which hopefully is what we see whistleblowers, and certainly later with the guy in Russia now, the NSA whistleblower.
Yeah, Snowden. You know,
Snowden. I mean, the thing Snowden has indicated has revealed to us about how our government operates against the actual American people. Maybe these wars, while they haven't been stopped by whistleblowers and people like me who have, you know, spoken out against them and kind of, you know, called the motivation into question. But maybe no less people were killed. Okay. No less money was spent. No less economies were destroyed in the Middle East. Okay. Nothing like that changed. But maybe people knowing that these wars were done under false pretenses and done for evil reasons, really. I mean, evil political reasons, nothing else. Maybe that's incited more whistleblowing. I don't know. I can only hope, because I can tell you, I never felt, I always believed I should have done more sooner, than what I was even able to do. And I was able to do, you know, really, and even bigger whistleblowers feel the same way. They feel like, well, you know, we whistleblew, but what really changed? Not much. And it's very frustrating.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is, you got to parse this a little bit there, Karen. I mean, you can't really measure with the counterfactual whether you changed the course of history or not. I wouldn't really be surprised if you had in some important ways, but you've certainly changed the hearts and minds of some individuals and spared them the grief of having to be bad on these things and rooting for these things. Now that they know better, they're released of that burden of cheering for this militarism and imperialism and mass murder. So
no, that's true. And
that
actually,
ain't nothing.
No, and that's a lot. And that's actually what I think your show does, antiwar.com does, Lou Rockwell does. I mean, there's a lot of places out there that provide an ability for people to really get the facts and to really understand the nature of the state and how that nature is integrated with war. And the war doesn't have to be anything, you know, there doesn't have to be any threats or any defensive concern. It just has, war is part of the state. It's the health of the state. And it's, when you know, it's one thing just to hear that quote, you know, war is the health of the state, and you go, oh, okay, some old guy said that. But then to really see how that operates, how that, comes into play really every day, every decade.
All right, now hold it right there. Hold it right there, Karen. We got to take this break. Breaking news. News.antiwar.com. Officials. Iran framework deal reached. Yeah. We'll be right back with the great Karen Kotowski. Read In Rumsfeld's Shop, Conscientious Objector, and Open Door Policy at the American Conservative Magazine and the new Pentagon Papers at Salon.com. Right back after this. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at ScottHorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com.
All right, they did it. Announcement's coming out tonight. Check out news.antiwar.com. The heroic Jason Ditz officials, Iran framework deal reached. They're going to make an announcement later tonight. Well, that's about 10 million pounds lifted from my shoulders. Finally, that just feels good. And cool, I always get to remember that this happened right in the middle of my conversation with my good friend Karen Kotowski. Pentagon whistleblower, author of the new Pentagon Papers at Salon.com, which I reread this morning. And please go and read The Lie Factory is all about her. That's Bob Dreyfus and Jason Vest at Mother Jones. And then the very important, all-important three-part series at the American Conservative Magazine in Rumsfeld's shop, Conscientious Objector and Open Door Policy. If you'd like, you could give us a brief comment on the Iran thing, or we could get back to talking about the Office of Special Plans and all of that.
No, I think the Iran thing is going to be great news. I haven't followed it that closely. The fact that, I'll tell you what I take my cues from, since I've been not watching a lot of news and staying up with things. When you see the kind of reactionary side of government, which of politics, which is both Republicans and Democrats being very upset about something, then you know it's probably good.
Right.
And you know, anything that can save lives is you know, a good thing, and this seems like it would help. But of course, they may not need to worry about peace in Iran because we got Yemen all blowing up. So
right,
you know,
there'll be plenty to bomb. Don't worry, guys.
Bomb. Lots of people are going to. We're going to. The market continues. You know, right. We're going to eat lots of more stuff, and so the war continues. You know, that business is not really diminishing, but it's nice to hear we won't be going into Iran because seriously. From a military perspective, and I don't know if this has ever changed, and I don't think it ever has, but for 30 or 40 years, I mean, really, since the time we put, you know, we overturned, you know, remember the CIA plot with, you know, to get rid of Mossadegh,
sure.
The elected guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, since 53, we have been, the military, I say we, I'm not in the military anymore. The military, Pentagon, has looked at what you would do to, could you invade Iran? And, you know, Iran is blessed kind of like the United States is blessed with a geography that is really difficult. It's like you do not want to go there.
Right, absolutely.
Any traditional type of warfare, you don't want to do it. And also, and this is, you know, since Carter promised we'll always defend the oil passing through the, you know, the Strait of Hormuz and whatnot, this, no matter what you, even if Iran had no weapons whatsoever, of course they have very few, and they certainly don't have any nuclear weapons, but they don't even have a really formidable military air force or anything like that. You know, they really just don't. But if they were messed with, if they were attacked, if they were, if they felt severely threatened, the damage they could do to global oil supplies, and not just in the short term, but for an extended period of time, is really unacceptable. So all these people that, you know, say, oh, we shouldn't deal with Iran. Well, you know, God's blessed Iran, politics, history, something's blessed them with a geography that really is an asset to that country. And, you know, you can't be underestimated how valuable that is. And so, you know, of course we should deal with them and not try to destroy them. The damage Iran could do to Western interests in terms of oil, is horrendous.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
You know, and so, you know, it just makes sense that we would deal with them. And the fact that so many idiot brains in this country can't understand that. This, I don't know. I don't know what to say.
All right. Well, tell me this. Who's Bill Luddy?
Bill Luddy. Well, he was our boss in Near East South Asia directorate and under in policy, in the policy directorate of OSD. And he was a neocon for sure in terms of his perspectives. He was placed as the head of that office by Cheney, Vice President Cheney, whose staff he worked. He was in Cheney's staff even during the election, before Cheney was vice president, but during that election time frame, Cheney put together a staff of people, and Luddy, and I don't know how he knows Cheney, but Luddy, who came from the Fletcher School at Tufts University, that's probably how he got hooked up. They've produced a number of neoconservative advocates from that School of Security Studies up there. So Cheney had been there. I mean, Luddy had been there. He ended up on Cheney's staff. And then pretty much from day one, early on, as soon as the new president, as soon as Bush 43 was sworn in, Luddy is assigned over to run this Near East South Asia shop. And he pretty much took his orders from Cheney, not necessarily from Rumsfeld or Wolfowitz, although Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Cheney all were of the same mind. Okay, there's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. They were of the same mind. And again, this was before 9/11. I mean, these guys weren't in response to 9/11. This wasn't like, oh, things changed all of a sudden after 9/11. Now we have these new enemies. We have to do these new things. No, this is part of a long process of shifting policy and creating war. I think certainly to create war was part of what the agenda was about. And I mentioned, I think in one of those articles, maybe the Salon article, maybe the American Conservative, I'm not sure, but I ran into a guy, this was after, let's see, when was this? Well, the decision to do war, I guess it was in the spring of 2003, before the invasion, but after the Powell thing to the UN, which was so infamous, mm-hmm. you know, when he testified all these things that, of course, weren't true. And supposedly he knew some of them weren't true. I don't know. But, you know, if I had four stars on my shoulder and I had that position like that, if I knew something wasn't true, I don't think I'd testify to it. You know, the man had power. He could make a choice, but he didn't. In any case, sometime after that testimony, which really put the nail in the coffin that we were going to go invade Iraq for sure, I ran into a guy, Navy captain, who I had worked with before, but I hadn't seen him. He had transferred out of our office into some other office, and I hadn't seen him for a long time. He had gone back to the Navy staff from OSD. And I ran into him and said, what have you been working on? He goes, well, you know, we've been working on the logistics for this war. And I said, what do you mean this war? The war, we're just now going to do the war. What do you mean? He goes, I've been working on this stuff for, you know, 9 or 10 months. I've been working 14 hour days trying to get the logistics ready for this invasion. So he started, when I saw him backing it up, he started in the spring of 2002, which was before the formation of OSP, which was before the propaganda campaign at home. So bottom line, you know, Rumsfeld, just as was noted after 9/11 when he infamously said, you know, we got to blame this on Iraq, Saddam Hussein, scoop up everything. This is what has to happen. You know, they knew what they were going to do. And they knew what they were going to do because they were organized even before Bush was elected. You know, the Project for New American Century, all this kind of ideology of taking down independent, secular, strong nations in the Middle East, you know, paving a way for eternal war. I mean, the war on terrorism, what is that? But an eternal war, you can't, you know, that's just the, I mean, they've changed so many things. And the thing was, it didn't just start in 2001. It started in the late 90s. It might have started. I mean, Wolfowitz has been key on this. It started with B-team stuff in the 80s. So, you know, just really awful to look back and realize how this country got played and is continuing to be played, mm-hmm. By, you know, by the neoconservatives and their ideology of war. And,
well, you know, Karen, I reread your Salon piece this morning, and you kind of make a big deal in here. It's the new Pentagon Papers again. And, you kind of make a big deal about how a lot of the career professionals in, you know, within, your eyesight there inside the Pentagon. They were all pushed out of their positions and replaced with guys straight from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs and the American Enterprise Institute. They just brought in all of these guys.
Political appointees. That's right. The political appointees, and you can create those C-class positions or whatever pretty easily. At least you could then.
Anybody and lower levels than the kind of people who would ever be political appointees, right? The guys who are actually doing the grunt work, even they came from JINSA.
That's right. And if any military folks came in, they were closely vetted, and they were the kind of people, unfortunately, like we see with General Petraeus, they were the kind of people that get promoted, okay, because they do exactly what they're told, and they don't think. And again, you know, I did pretty good up to a point, but really once, if you question authority, especially on these political issues, which are, this is the test of trust. This is the circle of trust kind of thing, you know, the neoconservative circle of trust. If you weren't inside of that circle of trust, you were gone. And they had a whole bunch of the sources. You mentioned these organizations, but the sources were there for people who truly, honestly, I could say honestly, but they did believe their own propaganda.
Right. Let me ask you this. This is a very interesting point. You mentioned this guy, I forget his name now. Bill Bruner was Ahmed Chalabi's handler. But I wonder who was handling who, because there's another very important article at Salon.com called How Chalabi Conned the Neocons, about how he was working for Iran all along, and how these neocons are a bunch of freaking idiots. They believed that the new Shiite-controlled Iraq was going to be best allies with Israel and build the oil and water pipeline to Haifa and all this crap. Were they really that stupid, Abram Shulsky and Richard Pearl?
Absolutely, because they are pure, they're the stereotypical pure academic. I'm not saying they were teaching classes, but they totally had no ground knowledge. And of course, it is well known that our human intelligence, back in that time and certainly today as well, is really bad in that area. It's just bad. We don't know, even the smartest, even the best informed people in our intelligence community don't know very much. So the standard of knowledge is already low. The smartest, wisest, most clued in folks in the Pentagon don't know much. Okay. Number one. Number two, these guys, these particular guys, the ones you mentioned there, Ludi and other folks who had been in academia, formerly military, some of them in Ludi's case, he was a Navy captain at one time. Richard Pearl and a lot of these basically lifetime, people that work in think tanks and really only talk to people that talk to them. Well, it's just like, you know, in COPS, you know, with your confidential informants and whatnot, you know, it's quid pro quo. They don't talk to you unless there's something in it for them. And that's probably most likely the Chalabi story. And I mean, I remember reading that back in the day when Salon published that, but certainly, these people who talk to the neocons didn't just, you know, they were not objective to begin with. And why would they talk to these idiots except they had something that these guys wanted, that Jollibee wanted? I mean, power, access, ability to influence decisions. So a whole bunch of people were played. But the question is, I think if you step back, who gets played and who doesn't get played? The well-informed people who are not arrogant, okay, who really kind of recognize the honest situation that they're in. People who are, you know, follow the law, for example. You know, these are the people don't get played. You know, my daughter is a security guard, prison guard, correction officer right now. Okay, so how do correction officers get sucked into situations that get them fired? You know, too much close contact, doing favors for inmates, etc. Well, how do they get sucked into that? They don't follow the rules. Okay, so if you do nothing more, you can be really stupid. Many people are stupid. Neoconservatives have no handle on being stupid. They are stupid in many cases, but a lot of people are stupid. But what keeps you out of trouble? Very often, following the rules keeps you out of trouble. The neocons had nothing but contempt for the rules, contempt for the Constitution, contempt for the rules of intelligence in the Pentagon, contempt for CIA and their process, contempt for tradition, contempt for the civilian backbone of the military, as they say, you know, certainly the folks that had been there year in and year out. They had nothing but contempt for them. These are the people that were moved out and replaced with you know, sycophantic, neoconservative-leaning political appointees. So that's how they do it. Could it have been prevented? Sure, sure. We have rules in place. You got to follow them. They didn't follow them. They didn't have to follow them. They didn't want to follow them. They didn't need to.
We got
to
stop. We're already over time. I've kept you into the top of the hour break here, and I got to get Todd Pierce on the line to talk about how these neocons have the exact same ideology as the German fascists
of
the pre-World War II era.
I'm so glad. I'll be listening.
Well, thanks so much for coming back on the show. It's great to talk to you again.
Sure enough, anytime.
All right, y'all. That is the great Karen Kotowski. Find her great article at Salon.com, The New Pentagon Papers. It's a real eye-opener. And also the three-part series at the American Conservative Magazine, In Rumsfeld's Shop, Conscientious Objector, and Open Door Policy. And she's got a gigantic, great archive over at LouRockwell.com as well. We'll be right back after this. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, kids, welcome back to the show. Well, you'll have to check the archives for the end of that Karen Kotowski interview. We went a little bit over time there. I tend to do that from time to time. These segments, they're just too short. All right, well, now we go to our friend Todd Pierce, a former judge advocate general in the, now I forget, the Navy? Here he is writing for ConsortiumNews.com, Neocons, the Echo of German Fascism. He was a, I know I'll get this right, a former defense attorney at Guantanamo Bay, who resigned rather than continue to participate in the farce down there. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. Thanks.
You were in the Army, not the Navy. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I'm in the Army. Let me correct something first. No, I didn't have to resign. I'm still actually on a case before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So.
Oh, really? As a JAG, though?
As a retired JAG now.
Oh, that's interesting. But still, but in the civilian court system, is that right?
Exactly.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's very interesting.
I didn't resign because as a defense counsel, that part of it was too important. If I'd have been a prosecutor, I would have resigned.
I see. And so, but you're representing a Guantanamo inmate right now?
Correct.
I see. Well, as long as we're on that subject, who?
I'm on a team and we're representing Al Balul before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and the only remaining issue to be decided, and it's under consideration yet, is whether or not conspiracy is in fact a war crime under international law, which we argue it is not. Right. The court has already ruled that material support for terrorism and solicitation are not war crimes, as they are not. So we're just waiting to see how they're going to rule on the conspiracy issue. And since it's still under consideration by the court, I don't want to say anything more about that.
I see. Okay, no problem. All right, so let's talk about this great article. This is so interesting. I forget if it's on antiwar.com today, or we ran over the weekend, I guess, at antiwar.com. It's written for consortiumnews.com, Neocons, the Echo of German Fascism. And you pick your words very carefully here. You're not talking necessarily about German Nazism, but a different flavor of German fascism from the time leading up to the rise of the Nazi Party and the beginning of World War II. Is that correct?
Exactly, and very deliberately so, because, you talk about and say, make an analogy to Nazis, and immediately people realize that that's just too extreme. We may be on a continuum, a spectrum at the lower end where the Nazis would be at the highest end. But obviously there's a lot of distance between wherever we are at and the Nazis. But you don't have to look at that. There's a variety of fascist parties and fascist movements, particularly during the interwar years. And one of those was, in fact, the German, basically the German military allied with the conservative revolutionary movement and then the Deutsche National People's Party, as I point out. All of them in their together would constitute a fascist movement of any, if it was in any other country other than Germany, where it was held up comparatively to the Nazis and not seen as bad. But it led to the Nazis.
Mm-hmm. And these were the groups that were the coalition that supported the Nazis' rise to power when Hitler, of course, as everyone knows, never did have a majority in the Reichstag.
Correct. They were competitors with the Nazis through the 20s. But as power was shifting and success was shifting to the Nazis, they were being brought into the Nazi orbit, you could say. So when the 1933 election occurred, the Deutsche National People's Party was part of that coalition that voted with the Nazis to give Hitler the enabling act and these extraordinary powers. A couple of them, like I say, they had been seen as competitors before, and a couple of them lost their lives, during the Night of the Long Knives, so-called Night of the Long Knives, when Hitler wiped out a number of his enemies. But many others remained in government and throughout till the end of World War II.
All right, so now break this down exactly. What's the difference between, American conservatism and this German revolutionary conservative movement, or are there any differences anymore?
Well, quite honestly, yeah, as of today, I don't think there are many differences. Obviously, different time and place, and we speak different language. But you look at what the Republican Party is saying, and this is what, I started reading about the conservative revolutionaries maybe 5-6 years ago in reading about Carl Schmitt. And so I was aware of them for a lot of years. And we've just evolved, as you can see, in Republican rhetoric, where today I don't think you could say there's any distinction other than time and place and language. But same foreign policy agenda, the conservative revolutionaries, and when I say that, I'm going to include everybody now, the Deutsche National People's Party, the German army, they all believed in expansionist foreign policy. They believed that Germany, being an exceptional nation in Europe, had a right to expand and actually rule over all of Europe at some point. And we've expanded that. Although we disguise it a little bit better, we actually believe that we rule the world. And I go back to Dick Cheney's 1991 draft policy guidance that I've written about elsewhere, where he essentially says that now we rule the world with the defeat of the Soviet Union. So we have been acting as if we have a right to rule the world, and both directly and indirectly.
Well, and now, wait a minute, not just acting like, but believe that we have the right. This exceptionalism is straight out of this German fascism. Is that
exactly
correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't mean to waffle in any way.
Well, but explain that. I mean, elaborate on the exceptionalism as they characterized it.
So as they characterized it, again, they held themselves up, and in Germany, as you know, was probably the most sophisticated country in Europe, at the turn of the century. And obviously you've got all these various Bach and Beethoven and others who had created this rich culture. So they had a very superior attitude toward everyone else. And we've got that today, as you know. And you can hear it every time Michelle Bachmann opens her mouth or others, Sarah Palin, Ted Cruz, on and on. And, we're the, sole superpower, the exceptional nation. Everybody here listening, knows what I'm talking about. So we go on. We have this firm belief that we are a exceptional nation. I mean, I was at a law school, University of Minnesota Law School, one day on something, and was invited to listen to a speaker that happened to be coming through. And in the course of that, he's saying, sort of soliciting an opinion, he said, "Well, I'm thinking of writing another book, making the argument that the United States and Israel, standing as exceptional nations, our motives are always pure in war, going to war, and yet we're always in war because of that. We're always having to fix these things. Therefore, we should be subject to a less strict law of war, so that our soldiers aren't going to be charged with war crimes." And he was seriously saying this, that we should, because we go to war more often, we deserve a lighter standard of conduct. And that's an example of how we have elevated ourselves, and in this case, you're Israel too, and I would say the Republican Party would agree with that, including Israel, mm-hmm. that we're above the rest of the world. We're exceptional not only in being superior, but we're also exceptional in not being subject to the laws of the world.
Right.
You know, international
now, let me ask you a little bit more about that, because my understanding when I was a kid, as I was raised in government schools about exceptionalism, was America's exceptional because we put freedom first. We believe in justice and in liberty, and that's what makes this society the best society, is because these are the organizing principles of our society. Where every other society is, you know, we are the this or that ethnicity, or we are the this or that religion, and that kind of thing. But I never understood it to mean that therefore our sins become virtues, and therefore we have the right to murder and kill and steal and lie and undermine the very principles of liberty and justice that we proclaim. So where did this go off the rails, or was I just fed a very kind of sugar-coated version of this when I was young?
Well, I think as a bit of a, you know, I was fed it too, and I believed it, and I still believe it in that sense, the way you describe it. But it was a little bit sugar-coated. As I mentioned in the article, you know, certainly Native Americans weren't treated, you know, charitably and whatnot. We've always had a faction that was varying in strength at different times in our history that was always militaristic. But where we went off the rail, I would say, and I would really date this, we've always had this. You go back during, and I used to call myself a conservative and even a neoconservative back in the 80s, but during that time, in part in rebellion against the loss of the Vietnam War, and I can quote some Vietnam generals and how they talked about how next time you have to be more authoritarian, lock up anti-war dissenters, etc. But I think that was sort of our stab in the back, the beginning of our stab in the back to a certain faction, you know, the right wing, the extreme, more extreme right wing. And I don't mean the Nazi Party and those, but I mean the more extreme right wing of the Republican Party, like Dick Cheney. And to them, we were stabbed as a nation in the back by the anti-war activists and the press. And the military is replete with writings such as this. Mm-hmm. And so we have our own sort of stab in the back legend. But it was never manifested as it has been since, because we're always sort of checked by the Soviet Union. And I'm not holding them up as a virtue, you know, as something that was good to have around, because they were a check upon us. But with their collapse, I think we saw sort of Dick Cheney's Mein Kampf, right, with, like I say, in Paul Wolfowitz, very much in Straussian, right, with their 1991 draft defense planning guidance, where they basically said...
I'm sorry, Todd, let me interrupt you here and stop you here. We actually went into this break a little bit, but I don't want the live audience to miss too much of this. So hold it right there, and we'll be right back in just 1 second, okay?
Yep.
Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Okay, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Todd Pierce, former Army JAG lawyer, but still a lawyer representing a Guantanamo inmate in the civilian court system. He's got this incredibly interesting and important article at consortiumnews.com called Neocons, The Echo of German Fascism. And so we kind of went a little bit into the break there, talking about the stab in the back theory, just like Hitler's stab in the back theory after World War I. We have our own after Vietnam about how, oh, the liberals sold us out and all this, and how, and this is part of the basis of the modern American right-wing nationalist point of view, as represented especially by Dick Cheney and then his acolytes like Paul Wolfowitz. But now, so
Todd, you can tell we're just so compressed for time in these segments here. See if you can draw a line for us from Ernst Junger, Carl Schmitt, Leo Strauss, and through to the neoconservatives in America today, please, sir.
So I think probably everybody listening here most know of the neoconservatives. But jumping ahead then, 9/11 was what, you know, this convergence of circumstances, Dick Cheney in the vice president's office, et cetera, and then this attack on the United States is what allowed the neoconservatives, many of whom were in office and had been pushing for various wars, you know, for at least a few decades. But all of a sudden, all the circumstances came together. The authoritarianism came out in the various Office of Legal Counsel opinions written by Robert Delahunty and John Yoo, arguing that the president has these extreme dictatorial powers under the war powers. So all of this came together. Strauss had always been an influence. And when you know, the other Scott Horton of Harper's Magazine is, in fact, the one who translated that piece about Strauss's letter to Carl Levitt, I believe is how it's pronounced, saying that I'm a fascist, basically. So, and then here Strauss comes over, contrary to many of the German emigres, Jewish emigres during World War II who were, you know, liberal left, Strauss was right wing and has been very influential in conservatism ever since. And so all these things came together at the same time. You had the Straussian influence, which again was very fascist. He always hit it, and I think this is relevant because people like Victor Davis Hanson writes a lot on war and why we need to, and he goes back to the Spartans and celebrates war. And they hide it, you know, they hide their fascism because the Spartans were a fascist, you know, early version of fascism. So they hide their fascism by going back to the ancients to try to pretend that, well, here we have to look up to the ancients, and here's how we should model ourselves. So it's diabolical in a lot of ways, but with 9/11, it all come together. And then wartime itself has its own psychological effect upon people, where attitudes become more and more severe. It's extreme. As Carl Schmitt talks about, you have to have the friend-enemy distinction, and nowhere ever is that more evident in wartime, it seems. So we've got the enemy now. It's not the Jews like the Germans had, the Nazis came to have, and then Hitler had it from the beginning, the end of World War I, but rather it's Arabs. And we can see this by a lot of neoconservatives going on, and, you know, the Islamophobia against any Arab, against any version of Islam. So everything is coming together, and the Republican Party epitomizes that. You know, everything comes together in the Republican Party. And the Democrats, too. I'm not leaving them out. Menendez, Schumer, Hillary Clinton, Warren, even, you know, we have a benevolent, you know, generous view of her because of her, you know, criticism of Wall Street, but she's been quoted here a couple different places, probably on antiwar.com today. She's very pro-war. And so this has become the American, you know, worldview now. And like I say, it's exactly as you could have seen in Germany in the 1920s, espoused by the conservative revolutionary movement. Mm-hmm.
And now, I'm sorry, one slight correction for you here, and it's mostly not your fault. John Pilger screwed this up and I guess never corrected it, but it's a quote from Michael Ledeen at a meeting at the American Enterprise Institute where he says, "This is total war. And if we just let our vision of the world go forth and we embrace it entirely, and we don't try to piece together clever diplomacy, but just wage total war, our children will sing great songs about us in the future." You can just tell that that's a Ledeen quote there. Richard Perl talks quieter than that, I think.
Oh, okay. So it's Ledeen that said.
Point still the same for sure, yeah. And in fact, Michael Ledeen is actually like a pretty open fan of at least Italian fascism, if not avowedly a fan of German fascism. He even wrote a book about it and what all positive things we can learn from Mussolini and his group.
No, that proves my point, you know, which you would agree with, I have no doubt. Ledeen represents the Republican view today. The Republican Party, you know, starting off at 9/11, it wasn't entirely this way, but it's evolved to where now you could say it's 100%. And in part, that comes with a connection, I would say, to Netanyahu. We don't see him as a fascist, but his roots are, you know, ideological roots are fascist, as I point out in this article. And we saw that particularly on display last summer with all the rhetoric going on in Israel, as people like Max Blumenthal have documented, on how extreme that rhetoric has become in Israel. And I've talked to a couple friends who have said, you know, they're not sure that we're not past that tipping point, at least Israel. And I would say that may be, and I think it may well be true of the United States too. I don't know how we're going to reverse this. We've now got a person, Rosa Brooks, who used to write very eloquently against the Bush administration. She's written a piece recently basically saying that, hey, we're stuck in this permanent war. Get used to it. Let's just put a couple rules on it to make put a little lipstick on it. But let's just get used to it.
Right. And, you know, I was going to say, Todd, well, maybe if we just lose another few wars, that'll help. But actually, that just makes matters worse, right? Because then it's all your fault for criticizing, pal, or else we would have won.
That's true, too. And that's that goes along with that fascist viewpoint. Anybody, any internal enemy, any internal dissent is the enemy. And so it requires this very oppressive police state to suppress any dissent so that the wars won't be lost. But of course, I have argued elsewhere that, in fact, that's a strength of the United States, as it once was, democracy, is that we can have that internal debate. If you look at the Vietnam War, you had people, generals, who wanted to fight that war to the last dollar, to the last American dollar that we could spend. They would have bankrupted us, and they wouldn't have won the war. Whereas the peace movement said, hey, get out of here. It's unwinnable, et cetera. And fortunately, we did eventually for a number of reasons, but I would say in most part because of the peace movement. And instead of bankrupting ourselves, you had a number of years of prosperity where, at least for a few years, we were willing to live in peace with the rest of the world, mm-hmm. at least to a larger degree than we had been.
Well, and it seems like a very important point, as you say, that the Democrats are just about as bad as the outright neoconservatives and avowed right-wing nationalist, Dick Cheney, ites or whatever you call them, the Cheney-Rumsfeld types. And you know, so we lived through 8 years of Bush Jr. and this way of thinking. Then Obama comes, and it's just a ratification of the exact same set of principles rather than any kind of real rollback. And then as we move further on, next is Jeb or Hillary or whoever comes next. And, you know, the longer we go on like this, the less connection the American population has to how things used to be and what exactly it is that we're giving up here. The Bill of Rights is a dead letter. Of course it's a dead letter. It's been a dead letter for 20 years, so now it's too late to even fight for it, kind of an attitude. It seems really dangerous here.
You're exactly right, Scott. I mean, I you said it far better than I could have. The more time goes by living under this war paradigm, this notion that we're locked in this long war, as the neoconservatives love to say, the less likelihood there'll ever be that we can get back and restore the Bill of Rights. And I would say, looking at it militarily, that's the worst thing that can happen to us, because we gradually centralize all decision-making authority into the very people who are the least broad-minded, the least able to understand the larger issues,
right,
so that we become a militarized state, just like the Soviet Union was at its worst, Germany was at its worst, and the only thing they can think of is one more attack and everything will be well and good.
Right,
finally they get to Stalingrad or Afghanistan, as the Russians did, and everything collapses.
Right.
And that's,
you know, we just finished talking with Karen Kotowski on the show, and she had a front row seat to these neoconservatives, Richard Pearl and Elliot Abrams and their acolytes in the Pentagon, lying us into war back in 2002 and 3. And the discussion ended on how they're idiots, these guys. They only talk to each other. They really don't know anything about anything. Not a one of them speaks a lick of Arabic, for example, or anything like that. And they're not even willing to listen to the CIA. They're not even willing to listen to anybody from another think tank who thinks they're wrong. And so this is how they were so easy for the Ayatollah Khamenei and Ahmed Chalabi, his agent, to manipulate into getting rid of Saddam Hussein for them. They thought it was going to be good for Israel. They thought that Iraq, democratic Iraq, was going to be Israel's best ally and build an oil and water pipeline to Haifa and all this complete nonsense, because they don't know anything, because they're not interested in knowing anything other than what confirms their bias. So they can only bring us to Stalingrad, right? They can only destroy us and never succeed.
That's exactly right. And that's what the American people need to realize. We've come to celebrate militarism and the military so much, but we don't realize that they're the most narrow-minded group of people. You know, so starting off with the idiocy of the neoconservatives, which you know, is in the extreme, but it's infectious. And so you can see the same idiocy in the CIA, like if you read the torture report. It was a clown show. These people, the CIA running the, and I would say the military too, the Senate report only covered the CIA. Mm-hmm. But these people who were genuinely clowns, they thought, you know, if we just torture this guy a little bit more, he's going to reveal where Osama bin Laden is or some other nonsense. And they didn't even know that these guys are maybe just farmers or, you know, or whatever. They exaggerated everything because they're fearful. They're the most fearful people we have in society. Instead of brave, courageous, warriors, as they like to see themselves as. So we need to begin looking at them as clowns again. You know, we used to have some great movies back in the 60s, you know, like Dr. Strangelove and Catch-22, where it was routine to, you know, make fun of, this military mindset. And I'm including that. I mean, again, the neoconservatives, Republican Party are equivalent to the Deutsche National People's Party. The CIA, the military, they're equivalent to the German army of the time. Each very narrow-minded and not understanding things very well and leading, as I say, to Stalingrad. So that's what we've got going today. But we got to realize that these people are genuinely idiots and clowns. Other than you give them a very narrow, specific mission, they may be able to find that. But once you give them too much discretion, and Scott Horton, the other Scott Horton, has written a great book, Lords of Secrecy. Mm-hmm. Let me put tout that book. And they can cover everything up with secrecy, though, over-classifying information, et cetera, making a crime for anybody like a whistleblower to reveal to the American people what idiots they really are. Yep. And, you know, that's what the Bill of Rights was really about to begin with. It wasn't about giving us rights to have fun, but it was about giving us the means to keep an eye on our government functionaries, because the framers understood that giving them, you know, free rein to do whatever they want would lead to catastrophe. So ultimately, it was meant to be the American people using the Bill of Rights to keep an eye on those government functionaries like the CIA, the military, Congress, a president. And that's been turned upside down.
Yep. All right. With that, we better leave it. But I'm going to beseech the audience, please go and look at this very important article. And you know what? Give it to your professors. Post it. Spread it around. This is the kind of thing that really needs a thorough examination. It's called Neocons, The Echo of German Fascism. It's by Todd Pierce at ConsortiumNews.com. Thank you so much, Todd.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
Appreciate it. And, well, look at that clock. I think we're already back from the break here. So, yeah, I know I don't organize a live radio show very well, do I, guys? Well, if you want to listen to the 4 minutes of missing interview that you didn't hear during the break there, just go to scotthorton.org/interviews later on, and we'll have the full interview archive there from Todd Pierce. And, again, it's a really great article, man. You guys will learn a lot from it. At ConsortiumNews.com, Robert Perry's site there. Okay, so now back to our top story of the day here, which is that they've got a dang deal. And I guess it's not, you know, 1,000,000%, but they say that all they have to do is dot a couple of I's and T's, and they're making an announcement tonight. They are going to make a joint statement tonight, just in advance of the deadline, announcing that they have, what the hell are they calling it? It's not the absolute deal. It's the framework of the deal. So it's the they still have till the end of June to get all of the very technical details out of the way here. But they have finally, Barack Obama and John Kerry have succeeded in forging the final status deal with the Iranians over their already safeguarded and perfectly harmless civilian nuclear program. So here's what it says. Officials, Iran framework deal reached. Nations talk up new phase, aiming for final deal by the end of June. It's by Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Officials are saying the framework talks between Iran and the P5+1 is more or less finalized, and there will be a joint statement made later Tuesday evening, which, hey, it's Tuesday evening in Switzerland right now, so come on with it. Though it isn't necessarily being presented as the framework deal by all reporters, make no mistake, this is it. The framework deal was never expected to be more than a rough 2 to 3 page outline and just provide a basis for the final deal, which they aim to reach by the end of June. The reports coming out of Lausanne suggest that's exactly what we're going to get tonight, And while officials are still trying to dot their I's and cross their T's, this is the framework we were promised. Not that we're likely ever to see the text itself. That's because officials never really promised to make the framework public, and several nations, the U.S. in particular, have been keen to keep disclosures about the exact terms of the pact limited. Whatever we learn in the hours to come, the framework deal itself is hugely significant. Within the U.S., it will now be the job of the administration to affirm that this is indeed the framework they've been talking about, to tamp down any efforts by the now-recessed Congress to impose sanctions on the grounds they didn't notice or particularly care for at the press conference. I love Jason, man. He's so great. So, it's a manufactured crisis. It always was nothing but a manufactured crisis, and now it's put to bed. But you know me, I'm a horrible, hateful, cynical bastard, and I have to say that I'm afraid now, I have to switch straight to negativity. I'm afraid that this means that it will be easier for America to ally with Iran in Iraq, which would be the worst thing in the whole world, because as we were just discussing with Karen and with Todd Pierce, that's a pro skater from the old days. Todd Pierce, the judge advocate general. The plot to invade Iraq, as much as Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz thought it was their idea, it was really the Ayatollah Khamenei's idea. And it was the Ayatollah and his intelligence services that helped Ahmed Chalabi and his Iraqi National Congress come up with all the lies that were used to lure us into this war. If you just search CIA, DIA, Chalabi, you can read all about it in the Jewish Daily Forward or in, I think it was the Seattle Post-Intelligencer had a great write-up about this. And I never tire of recommending this article because it's got some laugh out loud moments in it for sure. It's called How Ahmed Chalabi Conned the Neocons at Salon.com. And I know Salon is ridiculous, but back in the day, they used to actually put real journalism in there from time to time. And this one is by a guy, I forget his name, but he's a writer for the Financial Times, had an exclusive for Salon, but don't let the Salon.com address turn you off. It's a great article, man. It really is. And the thing is, that's why the Iraq War was so horrible. It wasn't just because America invaded. And it's not just because they then debathified the entire government and abolished the entire army and sided with the Shia. It's that they sided with Iran's hand-picked sock puppets to be the leaders of the Shia, primarily and most importantly, Abdul Aziz al-Hakim and his faction, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, who came across the border from Iran right there in March of 2003. Jonathan Landay explained on the show he was there. He saw him with his own eyeballs coming across the border. And they had their own private army, which you're probably a little bit familiar with, called the Badr Corps, or the Badr Brigade. Prothero says they now call it the Badr Organization, right? Like the Mujahideen-e Khalq. Oh, no, we're just an organization. Well, they're a militia of the most cruel torture murderers outside of Washington, D.C. And if you only ever just Google Iraq and the El Salvador option, you can read all about, and especially because of the heroic Chelsea Manning and the leak of the Iraq and Afghan war logs. But in those Iraq war logs, you can read all about how they hired this guy, James Steele, who was a professional killer from the days of the Reagan administration in South America. And they brought him in to recruit the Badr Brigade to lead in the so-called decapitation strikes against the primarily Sunni-based insurgency. And, of course, you can already see right there, right? Who's zooming who, pal? Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush and the American Army and Marine Corps, they didn't hire the Badr Brigade to be their auxiliaries. The Badr Brigade hired them. And those 5,000 Americans that died, they died fighting for the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. It's now called the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq. Same difference. And, well, they got their revolution, right? So they could drop that. They're not for revolution anymore
America won it for them. And these are the guys who, despite what you saw in the recent movie, it was America's allies that used power drills to torture and murder their enemies in the Sunni-based insurgency to death. It was their civil war with America fighting as the sock puppets of the Iranians that got a million people killed. And yes, the Sunni-based insurgency and their allies in Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Zarqawiites, they played their part. No doubt about it. They were the perfect counterpoint, basically, to the Badr Brigade. But these are the most horrible bastards in the whole world that America and Iran right now are backing in their battle for Tikrit. And the more America fights for Iran in Iraq, the worse we make the situation for the Sunni population, the more we drive the Sunni population into the arms of the Islamic State. Patrick Coburn's been on this show over and over and over again. He's written it in The Independent over and over and over again that if you ask the Sunnis of Mosul, if you ask the Sunnis of Fallujah or Ramadi, they will tell you, man, we hate the Islamic State. We're terrified of the Islamic State, but at least they're not the Badr Brigade. At least they're not the so-called Iraqi army that America and Iran worked together to install in power in Baghdad. So, yes, we want peace with Iran. No, we do not want alliance with Iran to fight this war in Iraq, nor should we prefer to back Saudi against them like we are in Syria and Yemen right now. Not that I'm convinced that Iran is even in Yemen. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, well, I should have emailed him and let him know. I was trying to call Jason, see if I could get a 10-minute interview with him here real quick. But anyway, I'm going out for hamburgers, man, to celebrate for lunch. It's about time that got something to celebrate here on the show, man. They got their nuclear accord, man. They did it. Officials, Iran framework deal reached. News.antiwar.com. And, you know, these idiots on CNN this morning, oh, yeah, you know, if they don't get the Iran deal, then they're going to go right back to building nuclear bombs. Would you shut up? For Christ's sake, I'll tell you what, anchor lady, why don't you spend 15 minutes reading something? I mean, I know that you're not, you don't have to know anything to be an anchor lady on CNN, but, you know, you could, I don't know, after dinner, spend a couple of minutes on Google trying to find out facts. For Christ's sake. They're going to go back to making nuclear bombs, huh? Yeah, just like Saddam Hussein is reconstituting his nuclear weapons that he never constituted in the freaking first place. What are you saying? It's like you're lying, only you're so stupid you couldn't possibly be lying. You just have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. Anyway, they did it. John Kerry did it, man. And, good. And got their nuclear framework. All right, now, here, man, let me tell you a couple other things here. I'm not sure if you could hear me, as we're going out to that hard break. I always try to sneak in one last phrase, and, it doesn't always work. But I have not seen the slightest bit of evidence that Iran is backing the Houthis, the Shiite faction in Yemen, in their war there. It could be true. Obviously, any of us can imagine why the Iranians would want to back the Houthis in a sort of proxy war with the Saudis or etc. But I'm just telling you, I ain't seen any proof of that. And the fact that TV goes, oh yeah, the Iranian backed Houthis without ever even pretending to prove it, I mean, Barbara Starr at CNN, the Pentagon spokeslady, I think she may have cited anonymous sources, but she certainly never cited what evidence that they supposedly were even referring to. Right? She could have said, anonymous sources say that they have intercepts that prove, or they found a boat full of guns, or anything. So, I don't necessarily doubt it. But, yeah, I don't know. I do doubt it. I don't necessarily dismiss it. But obviously there is a motive, a corrupt motive on the part of the war party to try to make the crisis in Yemen seem like it's all created and run out of Tehran. So, start out with not believing them, and wait till they come up with some actual evidence, please. But here's a great little piece that a friend sent me this morning, or yesterday in the email, from Zero Hedge, and he's quoting the George Washington blog, which very often has great stuff. It says, confused about the war on Yemen? Here's what's really going on. Yemen, previously called Aden, has one of the oldest civilizations in the Middle East, but it has been racked with violence for a long time. In the 60s, a pro-Arab nationalist faction clashed with the British, who wanted Yemen to become a Western-controlled natural resource hub, and devolved, which they owned it for a long time before that, in fact, and devolved into brutal fighting with both sides using terrorism. Yemen's first president, Saleh, was in power from 1990 to 2012. The U.S. supported Saleh, but Saleh was a double-dealing scoundrel. The Arab Spring protests ousted Saleh, and America helped broker immunity from prosecution in return for his leaving office. As the UK Telegraph reports, for years, the Americans saw President Ali Abdullah Saleh as a key ally in the fight against Al-Qaeda. He allowed his air bases to be used by U.S. drones to strike at the movement's operatives. And, of course, whoever, you know, happened to be around or happened to be mistaken for them or, yeah, that kind of thing. And gladly received Western aid in development cash and arms supplies. Yet, according to claims in a UN report last month, one of the first things Mr. Saleh did when his three-decade rule was threatened by the 2011 Arab Spring was strike a secret deal to give the entire southern province to Al-Qaeda. The more he could portray Yemen as falling into the hands of militants, he calculated, the more the West would want to keep him in office at all costs. Also, I highly recommend Jeremy Scahill's work in The Nation magazine. Blowback and some other... Oh, it's Yemen Policy Backfires, something like that. So Scahill Yemen Backfires will be your keywords there. And that's exactly what he talks about, is how America kept giving him all this money and all these arms, and he's using it against all of his enemies. And then, of course, he has only one incentive, to make sure that the Al-Qaeda threat remains so that he can keep getting more money and more guns. You know, it's a government program. They can only fail upwards, well, to a point. But the people of Yemen overthrew his sorry ass in 2011 and 12 with the Arab Spring. And so continues George Washington's blog, being quoted here at Zero Hedge. The U.S. brokered Saleh's replacement by Yemen's current president, well, if you can call him that, Hadi. Hadi was a longtime high-level assistant to Saleh. I believe he was his cousin, no? I guess I could be wrong. The presidential election ballot had only one choice: Hadi, and they actually have a picture of the ballot here. And, of course, Hillary Clinton was on the record praising this as democracy. Yeah, democracy, like in the USSR. Oh, yeah, we have elections. You can only vote for the Communist Party. But, yeah, you know, you get to vote, though. The opposition, which took over the country, I swear I'm getting to the point, and it's a very interesting one. The opposition, which took over the country, the Houthis, also called Zaydis, are violent fundamentalist idiots. Yes, they are closer to Shiites, like the majority in Iran, than Sunnis, like in Saudi Arabia, but they are virtually indistinguishable from Sunni fundamentalist terrorists in their behavior. Hadi is such a traitor to his own Yemeni people that he is calling for a foreign power Saudi Arabia to keep bombing Yemen until his opposition is defeated. But here's the kicker. Guess who is behind the Houthi revolt that led to the taking over of Yemen from Hadi? If you guessed Iran, you're wrong. It's deposed President Saleh. He's back. Indeed, the reason that the Houthis were able to take over the country so quickly is that many of the troops and police are still loyal to Saleh. So, at Saleh's instruction, while the Houthis advanced, the soldiers and guards simply walked away from their posts when he told them to. Bottom line, there are no saints in this conflict. Many are calling this a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, but it's not. Initially, Saudi Arabia is directly bombing Yemen. It's not doing so through a proxy. Moreover, while Iran is sending Houthis some money, this is really a power struggle between two corrupt idiots, Saleh and Hadi. Iran is not very involved. And I'll buy that. I haven't seen any evidence or even any assertion of evidence, credible or not, that Iran is backing the Houthis. And of course, you know, Saleh, he fought against the Houthis for a long time until they became useful. And that was always his game. That is always his game. There's a recent piece we ran over the weekend, or maybe on Monday, by Adam Barron, who's McClatchy's guy in Yemen, called What We Get Wrong About Yemen. And he was talking about, what was my point going to be about what Adam Barron was saying there? Oh, about how this was always how Saleh ran things, was just like Saddam Hussein ran things. I mean, people say Saddam Hussein was Hitler when they're trying to justify a war, but what he really was Tony Soprano. He was the mob boss, and he's trying to keep everybody balanced by brokering deals, paying off this faction. Then when they get a little too powerful, then he pays off this faction to oppose them and check them back and that kind of thing. And that's the same sort of thing going on here. And a little bit of insight into what's going on in Yemen. And that article you can find at Common Dreams, by the way, What We Get Wrong About Yemen by Adam Barron. From Thursday the 26th. And that's it for the show. I'm sorry I didn't get to talk about Syria or Palestine today, but, or Bergdahl, but we'll be back here tomorrow, noon to 2 Eastern. Thanks y'all for listening.